This is Chapter Day. I'm Jim Fleming. I'm reading from Little Hawk and the Lone Wolf. It's a memoir by Raymond Cacatosh, published by the Wisconsin State Historical Society Press. He was born in 1924 on the Menominee Indian Reservation near Neopit, Wisconsin. He grew up surrounded by nature. He spent a little time at the Indian boarding school near Kashina, but then went back to his family, and somewhat to everyone's surprise, has made friends with a wolf. He's named it Colonel. In the last chapter, Colonel saved Ray from an attack by a vicious dog. Chapter 6. After Colonel killed the dog, he watched me carefully, and he'd growl if any dog got near me. This protective front made me feel like I was king of the hill, but it reminded me that I'd better keep Colonel away from Maggie Lyon's bulldog. Maggie, who lived halfway between school and my home, had a real mean bulldog that looked like a small tiger, light brown with black stripes. If that dog tangled with a buzzsaw, I bet he would have come out the victor. He had jaws any shark would be proud of. He ruled the road by Maggie's house, and most people would avoid the area. But I had to pass by her house every day. And every time the bulldog saw me approach, he would chase me for a little ways, and then return home with a triumphant gait. He was king of the territory, and he knew it. Maggie would always say, "Oh, he won't bite." But she would laugh when that dog chased me down the road. This had gone on for about a year. Now it was about the middle of February, and Colonel was all healed up from his fight with the other dogs. He seemed to have put on a few pounds, but at times I noticed he had cuts or bite marks on his legs, and I couldn't figure out why. Then one day I realized he had been mauled by the little bulldog. Colonel had a built-in timer, and when 3 o'clock rolled around, he would get restless and try to get out of the woodshed. One day, he was waiting for me after school, and he greeted me with his bushy tail wagging. I wondered how he got by Maggie's house. Her dog must have taken the day off, I thought. Now we would somehow have to get past her driveway on the way back. When we were in front of the driveway, I saw the dog running toward us, so I motioned to Colonel to get going. He obeyed and ran ahead of me. Hoping to get past without incident, all I could do was run. But the bulldog caught up with me and got me by the leg. Colonel turned to see that I was in trouble. By this time, I was on the ground, trying to kick the dog loose from my leg. Colonel jumped right over me and nailed that dog on the back of the neck, tore him loose from my leg, and threw him into the air. Now the fight between them really began. The bulldog was bleeding badly from the wound on his neck, but he was not about to give up. Colonel got him by the neck again and shook him like a rag doll. I watched, helpless to stop it. The bulldog got a good grip on Colonel's hind leg. Now what? Only one thing to do. I cheered Colonel on. I began to holler, "Get him, Colonel! Come on, Colonel, get him!" And this was the turning point. Colonel tore some flesh from the bulldog's neck. The bulldog grew weak but still would not let loose. "Get him!" I hollered some more. And each time I hollered, Colonel would tear off more flesh. Finally, the dog let go of Colonel's leg and fell over, dead. Now what? I checked to see how badly Colonel was hurt. He wagged his tail and went back to take another bite out of that dog as if to make sure he'd killed it. When we got home, my mother packed snow on Colonel's leg to make sure his bleeding stopped. Now we would have to face up to its owner. I ran halfway to the police station, hoping that the same policeman who helped me before would be there. I lucked out. He noticed me and asked, "Those boys bothering you again?" I told him it was something worse. "Maggie's bulldog," I said. He looked at the ceiling and replied, "We've had a lot of complaints about that dog. Someday I'm going to have to shoot it." "Well, you won't have to now." "Why?" he asked. "Because my wolf just killed it." He smiled and thanked me and my wolf. Then I showed him the bottom of my trousers where the bulldog had torn into my leg. The policeman was still smiling when he said, "That dog turned on me once, and Maggie did nothing to stop it." When Maggie found out about her dog, she came over to my house and started yelling at my mother. When she found out her dog started the fight, she seemed to back down a little. My mother showed her my torn trousers. Maggie said she was sorry and walked out. Now it was my turn to be protective. In order to keep Colonel safe, I could not permit him to wander away from home. I couldn't leave him alone for too long, either. Who would have ever thought a wolf needed so much protection. I had to put out signs near our home, "Tame wolf, don't shoot." I also had to tell people in town about Colonel. The people I told looked at me like I was a little loco, and some just laughed. Next, I had to train Colonel to stay away from the road. This took some time, but he was a good learner. While I took measures to protect him, I thought about the time I'd tried to shoot him. How could I teach him to be afraid of guns? People shoot things from their cars and don't care what they shoot. I hoped they'd see my signs. We were getting along just fine, and everything seemed to be in our favor, if only people would leave us alone. Colonel's keen hunting skills were extraordinary. When we went out hunting for partridges, he would stop when he spotted one, staring at a tree without moving. Following his gaze, I would spot the bird, take careful aim, and shoot it. And when it fell to the ground, Colonel would run to pick it up and return it to me with a wagging tail. Didn't take him long to track down a rabbit. All I had to do was point to a rabbit trail and tell him, "Go get him!" When I heard him bark, I knew a rabbit was on its way toward me. All I had to do was wait. One day we were hunting, and I told him, "Go!" He looked at me and then headed for the woods. He didn't return for some time, and I started to get impatient. Then, as I was about to walk away, he came running with a rabbit in his mouth and dropped it at my feet, his tail wagging. I bent down to give him a hearty hug. He licked my face and jumped on my arm as we rushed home. When I told my mother what he'd done, she looked at the rabbit and said, "Give him the whole thing." So I filled his dish and watched him eat. Then I noticed a small piece he'd left behind. He looked at me, then looked back at his dish. Would you believe he left that portion for me? So I made believe I ate it, and later I gave it to him. What an animal. "When things are going smoothly, beware," my mother always told me, and she was right. Here's what happened next. Late in February, the weather turned bitter cold and the schools were closed. We needed firewood. With an axe on my shoulder, I crossed the highway, turned to see if Colonel was following me, and noticed that he was nowhere in sight. A car passed by, and a moment later I heard a bang. I knew someone had fired a gun from the road. I ran toward the car. A man stood near his car, his rifle still pointed at the side of the road. I hollered, "Wait! What are you shooting at?" "A wolf," he replied. "This can't be happening to my wolf," I thought. The man pointed in the direction where Colonel must have been. I started running and soon saw a trail of blood. I knew he was hit, but I hoped it would be a minor injury. I found him still sitting up, and he recognized me, a good sign. After wrapping my coat around him, I ran back to the man who shot him. "Help me get him home," I pleaded. We carried Colonel home and put him in the woodshed. I made a bed for him, and my mother packed his wound with snow to stop the bleeding. I turned to the man who shot Colonel and said, "Didn't you see the signs I put out?" He shook his head no. I then asked him, "You know Mike's father?" He just hung his head and didn't answer. "If that wolf dies, someone in your family will die too," my mother warned him. He never said another word. He just walked back to his car. After the man left, we moved Colonel inside. As I held the snowpacks my mother prepared, she began to cry. She knew Colonel was badly wounded. But I didn't give up hope. All that night he lay there, motionless, and I just watched his breathing and prayed that each one wouldn't be his last. When the bleeding stopped, we put a Vaseline-soaked cloth on his wound. Now we had to wait and hope no infection would set in. Each time we changed the bandages, there were fewer signs of blood, and soon there was none, a good sign. I kept telling myself that he couldn't die, and that I had to do something. But what? I dozed off. When I woke, I noticed that his breathing had returned to normal. The east wind began to chase away the darkness. The sky brightened and the clouds were red. It was then I knew the great breath maker would let Colonel live another day. My mother put her hand on my shoulder and said, "The bleeding has stopped. Now all he needs is a lot of rest." "Will he make it?" I asked. "Wolves are tougher than dogs and are hard to kill." I hung my head low and said, "I know. I tried to shoot him once." My mother gave me a dark glance. "You better have a talk with the breath maker, or he'll never make it." As I brushed his head, I promised, "From now on, I'll be more careful, and I'll not let this happen again." Colonel licked his chops, and I knew he was thirsty. I poured a little water on his tongue and kept doing this until he'd had enough. Another good sign. "He's getting better," my mother said. All day I watched for his tongue and kept giving him water. There was no sign of infection, yet he still couldn't lift his head, so I just had to wait for further signs of improvement. The second day was the same as the first, except he was getting thirstier. On the third day, I saw him try to lift his head, and so, slowly, I lifted his head a bit more. To my surprise, he started to lick the water. Now I had to get some food in him. Chicken noodle soup. That was his favorite. I rushed to the store and bought him 3 cans. As he lay motionless, I put a pillow under his head and said to my mother, "He must be in a lot of pain. I can't let him suffer any longer." And just as I turned toward the door, my mother said, "Look, his tail just wagged." I turned back to see the most beautiful sight I could imagine. That old bushy tail flopped up and down. I opened one of the cans and warmed up the soup. Then I carefully lifted his head and watched, in amazement, as he lapped up the whole dish of soup. After he was done, I lowered his head, and his tail flopped a couple of times, as if to say thanks. I petted his head as he closed his eyes. I sat there with tears streaming down my cheeks, and I didn't care if the whole world saw them. Colonel was getting better each day, and I could see his strength returning. At times he tried to sit up. One day I helped him. There he sat, and we looked at each other. "You made it," I told him. My mother must have been watching, because she handed me a little hamburger and replied, "See if he can eat this now." I gave it to him, and to my surprise, he ate most of it. Now for some rest. As he fell asleep, I stroked his head. The breath maker had heard my plea. Colonel's wound consisted of a tear beneath his front leg. He must have been facing the gunman. The bullet had entered from the front and went clear through him. His leg muscles were not damaged too badly. He limped for a while, but seemed to heal a lot faster after limping around. The policeman heard about this, and one day he stopped to tell me that the man who shot my wolf was in the hospital. I asked what happened to him. The policeman reported, "He was impaled by the sharp end of a board under his right arm." This was the same area where my wolf had been hit. I smiled and said, "Well, that's what he gets for shooting my wolf." The policeman asked how Colonel was getting along, and I told him that he was getting better every day. He walked back toward his squad car, then stopped, turned, and said, "You take good care of him." Smiling, I assured him that Colonel was the one who took care of me. "He helps me hunt rabbits and partridges, and we even go fishing together," I said. The policeman shook his head and waved as he left. I knew the great breath maker had spared Colonel for me. Now I had to show my gratefulness by making some kind of offering. As I looked up at Father Sky, I said, "Thank you, great breath maker. Someday my Colonel will make you proud of him." They say there's no prettier picture than a boy and his dog, but there is one better. A boy and his wolf. Or is it a wolf and his boy? I spent the rest of that winter conditioning Colonel. People told me you cannot teach a wolf to do tricks like you can a dog. I disagreed. How do you condition a wolf? Easy. Be repetitious. Be rewarding. And always be in command. It took time, but we had a lot of that. While he was sitting, I gently took Colonel's paw and scratched it. Each time I did this, I would say, "Shake." Then I'd give him a tidbit. He seemed to like getting his paw rubbed or scratched. Soon the word "shake" was synonymous with getting a treat. Whenever he'd hear me say this word, he'd quickly put up his paw. Next, while he was standing, I'd give Colonel the command to sit. First, he didn't know what that meant, so I gently pushed his hind legs into a sitting position. That was always rewarded with a treat. It was the easiest of all the tricks, and it took him only 2 days to learn it. Getting him to sit up was a little more difficult because he had a tendency to fall sideways, so I had to hold him in that position for a few seconds. Then I would tell him to stay. This was the most difficult trick for him to learn. Teaching Colonel to roll over took longer. First, I managed to get him to lie down, and then I'd roll him over. After doing that for about a week, he would still lie there but not roll on his own. Took another week of me turning him before he finally started to roll over. I also taught Colonel to respond to hand signals. I'd tell him to stay, and then I'd walk a few steps and call him. No problem. When I called him, he'd come running. Then I would move farther away and make a motion with my hand. At first, I both used a signal and called. Soon, I could just use the hand signal. Of course, a boy could also learn a lot from a wolf. Loyalty, obedience, patience. Turn around 3 times before you lie down. Take a bath, and then go roll around in something rotten. By the summer of 1935, Colonel was about 2.5 years old. His coat was darker now, and he weighed close to 75 pounds. The gunshot wound he had sustained was completely healed, but he would have to be taught to fear cars and other people. Each time I heard a car approaching, I'd run and hide, then point to the car and shout, "Bad car!" This routine went on all summer. One day, he woofed at me for no reason, or so I thought. Then I heard a car approaching, and he ran for the bushes before the car was in sight. Now that's what I call good training. Or maybe it was just smart thinking by a wolf. Some people tell me a dog's worst enemy is his master. I halfway agree with them. I was determined to be a good master for my wolf. I had to be protective, or at least careful. One day we encountered a skunk. This is the only fearless animal in the world, and we were about to find out why. We tried to avoid a confrontation, but the skunk let out a squirt in our direction. Colonel sensed it was going to attack me, and, as usual, he came to my rescue. Before I could stop him, he tried to attack it. Well, he soon paid the price. He started to cough, and so did I. It was so hard to breathe, I had to rush over to the river and throw Colonel in. When we got home, my mother knew what had happened before we entered the house. She made me change clothes and gave me a fly sprayer that contained some kind of mixture. Whatever it was, it helped stop the odor. A porcupine is said to be an Indian's best friend, yet it can be a dog's worst enemy. On our way to our fishing hole, Colonel ran ahead and met up with a porcupine. He came back to me with a muzzle full of quills. He tried to rub them off on the ground. I ran home and got a pair of pliers to pull them out. While I did this, he just stood and let me pull them out of him. He seemed to understand that I was helping him. Each time I pulled one out, it made him bleed, so I'd put a cold, wet cloth on it until the bleeding stopped. He never whimpered and seemed to know what had to be done. I was thankful he didn't have any in his eyes. One day at the frog pond, I was startled by a big pine snake. Could have been the same one that scared my sister a year earlier. Colonel noticed when I jumped, and he came running over and saw the snake near my foot. He circled it and got it by the side of its head and threw it in the air. He did this several times, and then I noticed foam coming from his mouth. I thought he had rabies, so I ran home and told my mother what happened. She just laughed and said, "Don't worry, that's his way of protecting himself from poison." Another day, while I was sitting by the river, watching some birds building a nest, I noticed a car approaching and looked to see if Colonel was anywhere nearby. He was hiding. A white man got out and asked if he could have a picnic at the spot where I was sitting. I got up and said, "It's all yours." And then I added, "You don't mind sharing it with a wolf, do you?" "A wolf!" he shouted. He turned to see Colonel standing there, sniffing the air. Now this was a big white man. And when he saw Colonel, he turned even whiter. He turned back to his car. I knew he was scared, and I tried to assure him that Colonel would not harm anyone. He didn't seem convinced. So I told Colonel to sit. Then I told him to roll over. The white man still wasn't convinced. I told him that Colonel just wanted to shake his hand. "Really?" he asked. I warned him to give Colonel a tidbit to reward him. He reached into the back seat and got a piece of a sandwich. After he shook hands with Colonel, he told me, "No one will ever believe I shook hands with a real wolf." With a fishing pole on my shoulder and my wolf at my side, who could ask for anything more? We were 2 lone wolves and didn't give a hoot about anything. Well, except skunks and porcupines. We fished and hunted a lot of the rest of that summer. Sometimes we would just sit and watch the clouds roll by. When I looked at the sky, Colonel would sit by my side and look in the direction of my gaze to see if there were any partridges. These memorable times are etched in my mind, and I'll always cherish them. Sometimes I reminisce, picturing my wolf sitting in the snow, or sitting by the river, or just jumping around in our backyard. There will never be another one like him. The year 1936 was like any other, until my brother-in-law, Melvin, bought another Model A, a 1931 Tudor. Mel made frequent trips to and from Wittenberg, about 30 miles from my home, and on one of these trips he asked me to drive. Remembering what he taught me on the 1929 Model A, I got behind the wheel. This old four-cylinder had a stick shift on the floor. Now that I could reach the pedals a little easier, it made a world of difference in shifting. Melvin put his jacket behind me, which helped me turn the steering wheel better, and then he said, "Let's go." Shift pattern is an H-form, right?" I asked. "Right. 1, 2, 3, and reverses up to the left." He let me drive the rest of the way to his home in Wittenberg, and then back to my home. I pulled up to our house, and my mother gasped when she noticed I was driving. "We have a new driver," Mel told my mother. "All he needs is a little more practice." Next, I had to get a driver's permit. I had to study the road and hand signals and the little handbook on the rules and signs of the road. The most important thing was not to pass on hills, curves, railroad tracks, or in intersections. You didn't need a driver's license to drive on the reservation, but I wanted one. "Next time you go to Shawano, take me along so I can take the test," I told Mel. He said we'd go the next day. I had a hard time getting to sleep that night. The next morning, Mel said, "Shawano County Courthouse, here we come." On the way there, Mel asked me to identify all the road signs. The most important one, he told me, was the stop sign. "Look," he said, "it has 8 sides. The round one is a railroad sign. It has an X on it that means crossing." Mel dropped me off at the sheriff's office and advised, "You're on your own. They might keep me in there." As I approached the main desk, I asked, "Where do I take the driver's test?" The woman receptionist answered, "For whom?" I told her it would be for me. "Aren't you a little young to be driving?" she scolded. With a look of great determination, I boldly claimed, "I'll be 14 next year." The sheriff walked in, and the woman told him this little boy would like to take the driver's test. He looked at me and told me to follow him. We sat down at a table, and he opened up a book and asked, "What's the stop sign look like?" "It's red and has 8 sides with stop written on it." "Well, not bad. What's a railroad sign look like?" "It's round and white with a cross on it." He looked impressed. "What's an intersection?" "Well, that's where the two lines cross. They form 90-degree angles." "What are you, some kind of wise guy?" he asked. I told him, "I never smart off to police officers." "Okay. When does the law permit you to drive on the left side?" "When you pass, when the road is under construction, or when a policeman directs you to." "When are you not supposed to pass another car?" "On a hill, curve, railroad, or intersection." He smiled. "You just passed your driver's test." "Well, when can I start driving?" "Here's a note. It'll serve as your driver's license. Your permit'll be mailed to you within a week." With that note in my hand, I rushed out of the courthouse and ran down the steps and tripped over the last step and fell into a rose bush. When I got up, a cop was standing there. He asked me if I'd been drinking. I dusted myself off and said, "I just passed my driver's test." Looking bewildered, he advised me not to drive for a while. Now to find Mel and tell him the good news. Let's see. There were only 2 taverns in Shawano that he frequented. I hit the first bar, and there he sat with a glass of beer in his hand. With a note held high, I bragged, "Look, I just passed my driver's test." He took it from my hand to read it and was about to hand it back to me when the bartender asked if he could see it. Mel handed it to him, and he said, "Well, I'll be." When my driver's permit arrived, it looked like a regular license, except it was printed in red. This permit could be used only during daylight hours. In order to drive at night, I had to have an older person with me. My brothers never had driver's licenses because they didn't need one while driving on the reservation. That might explain why they got into so many wrecks. For me, this was the beginning of a newfound pleasure. and also a profitable sideline, transporting lumberjacks to and from the logging camps. But my good news made my mother worried. She thought I was too young to drive. She changed her mind once we needed transportation and no one else could drive outside the reservation. When she was convinced I could handle a car, she said, "Well, maybe we can buy you a new one." How would we pay for it? We saved all summer to buy a car. This included part of my cherry-picking money and some of my beadwork funds. People hired me to drive them to and from the nearby cities. Soon, I'd managed to save enough for a car, even though I'd never even owned a bicycle. Not long after cherry-picking time was over, my mother told me to ask Melvin to take us to Shawano. "We'll be looking at cars," she said. Little Hawk and the Lone Wolf, a memoir by Raymond C. Cacatosh, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. I'm Jim Fleming. I hope you're enjoying the book and that you'll be here again for Chapter Day.